Well, I'm delighted to be introducing to you this year's Lakatosh Prize, Lakatosh Award winner, Professor Abner Shimoni of Boston University. The Lakatosh Award, as some of you will know, was made possible by a generous endowment by the Latsis Foundation in honour of a very influential and enormously charismatic philosopher called Imre Lakatosh, who worked here at the LSE from 1960 until his untimely death in 1974. The prize is of £10,000 and is awarded annually to the author of the book judged to be the most significant contribution to philosophy of science, recent philosophy of science, from amongst the books that are nominated. And Abner Shimoni very deservedly won this year's prize for his exceptional two-volume collection, Search for a Naturalistic Worldview. Abner Shimoni has had a long and distinguished career as one of the weightiest thinkers in the philosophy of science. In recent times, he's made significant contributions to all the areas that he's worked in: probability theory and statistical inference, and scientific inference, the foundations of quantum mechanics, the nature of observation measurement, and many other areas. All of them touched on, all of them covered in his award-winning books. So I both welcome and congratulate him, and ask him to deliver his Lakatosh Award lecture. On our fundamental natural laws, the product of cosmic evolution. Professor Shimoni.
It is a great honor to be here. It's a great honor to receive the Lakatosh Award in memory of Imre Lakatosh, who was, in fact, my friend two and a quarter decades ago, and, in fact, a colleague for a short time. He was a visiting professor at Boston University for about a month a year for two or three years in the early 70s, and he was a guest at my house, so I like to talk in his memory. The title of my lecture, Can the Fundamental Laws of Nature Be Products of Cosmic Evolution, has suggested to some people that I would talk about the history of science. That is not what I intend to do. It is true that we have attained our present state of knowledge of fundamental laws, presumably not the final state, by an intricate historical process that suggests evolution. And it is interesting to inquire how accurately and with what reservations the term evolution in the Darwinian sense applies to the historical process of scientific development. I have strong reservations about characterizing the development of the natural sciences as evolutionary. Since scientific development is driven by a final cause, namely to find out the truth about nature, whereas the elimination of final causes is central to Darwinism. My intention, however, is to talk about the laws themselves as matters of fact concerning nature, rather than about the achievement of knowledge about these laws by human beings. Now, people may be baffled by this clarification of my topic. They may willingly admit that secondary or derivative laws of nature could be the product of evolution, but could not see how the basic laws themselves can evolve. Thus, the genetic code is certainly a law of biology. It is presumably the result of billions of years of trial and error on the part of interacting molecular species. Such, at any rate, is the thesis of prebiotic evolution. In this prebiotic evolutionary process, the basic laws of physics are usually supposed to provide the constant background for the trial and error of the natural selection that took place while precursors of the present genetic code were explored and assessed. It would make no sense, accordingly, to regard the basic laws of nature as products of evolution, because there would be nothing to provide the requisite constant background for the trial and error that produced them. Why then should we pay any attention to a manifestly irresponsible extension of the concept of evolution beyond its proper domain? There are, I think, three good reasons for examining without prejudice the conjecture that the basic laws of nature are products of cosmic evolution. One reason is respect for the depth and ingenuity of its proponents, which include the philosophers Charles Saunders Peirce and Alfred North Whitehead, and the philosophically inclined theoretical physicists John Archibald Wheeler and Lee Smolin, and I will make do some summaries of their ideas later. A second reason for taking the idea seriously is the difficulty of understanding the character of the modality necessity when that modality is applied to basic natural laws. After one has tried strenuously to understand in exactly what sense basic natural laws are necessary and has been discouraged with the answers offered by various kinds of rationalism, conventionalism, Kantianism, etc., one feels in desperation the appeal of the evolutionary conjecture. A third reason for taking the evolutionary conjecture seriously is that it leads one to explore a number of fascinating philosophical and physical ideas. And even if at present we cannot assess these ideas definitively, we can derive intellectual stimulation from thinking about them. In other words, there is something festive about the matters that I have proposed to discuss. And after all, festivity is appropriate in a ceremonial talk. The announced topic actually belongs to a family of general questions. I'll give you three different questions. They overlap and are more or less equivalent, but they emphasize somewhat different things. One is, what is the ontological status of a fundamental law of nature? Another question is, if a fundamental law of nature is necessary, what is the character of its necessity as contrasted, for example, to the necessity of a true proposition of number theory? A third version, what kind of reason for being can be offered properly for a fundamental law of nature is contrasted with a reason for inferring its truth from some sort of evidence. Now, this whole family of questions presupposes that there are such things as laws, natural laws, which are facts concerning the world, so that asking about their ontological status is not an empty exercise. This presupposition would presumably be denied by an instrumentalist philosopher of science who regards statements of laws in scientific discourse to be essentially devices for unifying and systematizing the data of experience. I have reasons for rejecting the instrumentalist interpretation of scientific discourse, but to give those reasons would be another talk. One more preliminary remark. The best candidates we have at present for fundamental natural laws are, first, the principles of quantum mechanics, the principles of general relativity, and the standard model of elementary particles. It is likely that none of these is literally true. There are considerations regarding each indicating the need to go beyond them. For example, the problem of quantizing general relativity, of combining our best theory of space and time with the general quantum mechanical rules. Nevertheless, the predictive and unificatory power of each of these three theories is such that they will almost certainly be good approximations in some appropriate sense to the better theories that will eventually replace them. And for our present purpose, the most important point is each of them is non-derivative in our present state of physical knowledge. Hence, even if we acknowledge the likelihood that they will be honorably displaced from the scientific worldview, we can use them as respectable stand-ins for the as yet unknown replacement. An appropriate historical starting point for analyzing the status of fundamental laws is the metaphysics and natural philosophy of Leibniz. He treats the question rationalistically, but does so, it seems to me, with an unprecedented clarity regarding the difference between mathematical and physical truth. And his rationalistic treatment deploys ideas, novel ideas of his time, such as the set of all possible worlds and sufficient reason. Ideas which figure in later treatments of our question, even treatments that depart very, very drastically from Leibniz's rationalism. Here are two relevant passages. There are two first principles of reasonings, the principle of contradiction and the second, he doesn't give his name for it here. It's usually called the principle of sufficient reason. He gives three articulations of this principle. The first is the principle that a reason must be given, that every true proposition, which is not known per se, that is, by analytically, because of its internal relation among the ideas that make it up, every true proposition has an a priori proof. That's one formulation. Or that reason can be given for every truth. Or the third version, as is commonly said, and he obviously does not think this is precise enough, that nothing happens without a cause. Arithmetic and geometry do not need these principles. This principle, he thinks they can be gotten from the principle of contradiction. But physics and mechanics do. The true cause why certain things exist rather than others is to be derived from the free decree of the divine will. Go to the next page. And the first of which is to will to do all things in the best way. That's the famous dictum that God chooses the best of all possible worlds. As there are an infinity of possible worlds, there are also an infinity of laws, some proper to one, others to another. And each possible individual of any world contains in its notion the laws of its world. The G, you'll see in the reference, that's to Gerhardt, who was the editor of the works of Leibniz, and the Russell is prefaced. The philosophy of life. Now, my comment on these passages. First is tangential. Leibniz is much too sanguine in his philosophy of mathematics about the possibility of actually deducing logical and mathematical proofs from the principle of contradiction. Even the true propositions of predicate logic require a richer basis than Leibniz realized. In a fortiori, this is true for this is the case for the true propositions of number theory and set theory. In philosophy of mathematics, I'm very close to Gödel's idea that a mathematical truth is analytic in the sense that it holds, quote, this is a quotation from Gödel, owing to the meaning of the concepts occurring in it. That's a much more general and more powerful statement than owing to the fact that it follows from the law of contradiction. But that's tangential. This emendation does not weaken Leibniz's distinction between mathematical truths, which hold in all possible worlds, and the fundamental laws of physics, which hold in some possible worlds. The laws of physics, he says, need the principle of sufficient reason. Now, Leibniz has no difficulty in applying the principle of sufficient reason to derivative physical laws. The sufficient reason for a derivative law being more basic laws together with boundary conditions and other relevant singular facts. What is distinctive about the metaphysics within which Leibniz's natural philosophy is embedded is the resort to theology in order to supply a sufficient reason for a fundamental law. He postulates that God's desire to choose the best possible world, together with his power to execute this choice, constitute the requisite sufficient reason. Leibniz's invocation of theology in order to preserve the principle of sufficient reason when one arrives at the extreme limit of physical law raises many further questions, the crucial one being whether the principle of sufficient reason holds in theology itself. Hasn't one just move back one step, the question of universality of the principle of sufficient reason. Leibniz answers this skeptical question positively and thereby claims to complete the structure of his rationalist philosophy. He does so by adopting and somewhat refining Anselm's famous ontological argument for the existence of God. He argues in two stages. He argues first for the possibility of a most perfect being, and then he reasons that the most perfect being, that is God, necessarily exists because existence is part of is obtained by unpacking the concept of perfection. Now, I admire very much the design of Leibniz's philosophical architecture, but this admiration goes along with a skepticism of its robustness. My skepticism results primarily from the penetrating argument of Kant that existence is not a predicate and hence cannot be established by unpacking the concept of perfection. That's it. That's it. In a nutshell, that is Kant's very powerful refutation of the ontological argument for the existence of God. Now, admiration for the design and coherence of Leibniz's architecture then has the devastating consequence that the applicability of the principle of sufficient reason to fundamental laws of physics is as vulnerable as the ontological argument for the existence of God, and therefore very vulnerable indeed. So that completes the first stage of my talk, a brief survey of a rationalist attempt to establish and explain the necessity of the fundamental laws of nature. With the failure of Leibniz's magnificent attempt at a rationalist philosophy, a fresh start is needed on the question of the status of fundamental natural laws, a start which abandons the ambition of extreme rationalism. Now, some advice about strategy can be learned from Joseph Conrad's Lord Jim, which has a wonderful character, the German entomologist Stein. Now, here's what Stein says. A man that is born falls into a dream like a man who falls into the sea. If he tries to climb out into the air, as inexperienced people endeavor to do, he drowns. Nicht wahr? No, I tell you, the way is to the destructive element, submit yourself, and with the exertions of your hands and feet in the water, make the deep, deep sea keep you up. Now, what's the relevance of this? The relevance is that the advocates of an evolutionary explanation of fundamental natural laws are followers of Stein, and the destructive element in which they seek support is the sea of contingency. Now, why should this work? Well, what inspired a few scientists and philosophers to propose fundamental natural laws emerge out of contingency is the intellectual coherence of the neo-Darwinian theory of biological evolution. So let me say a few things about the structure of the modern theory of evolution before going to the much more ambitious program of cosmic evolution. The biological theory of evolution has three major components: a theory of variation or mutation, a theory of selection, and a theory of inheritance. The theory of inheritance, of course, is necessary in order to explain how those mutations which are selected somehow are preserved. Now, of these, the first and third have developed most radically, that is, the theory of mutation and the theory of inheritance have developed radically in the century and a half, from Darwin to Mendel to Morgan to modern biochemistry. I maintain, by contrast, that no new fundamental principles have been brought into the theory of natural selection since Darwin's time, for the simple reason that the theory of natural selection never did have any principles of its own and does not need any principles. I have argued elsewhere that there is such a thing as phenomena of natural selection. There is a theory of natural selection, but it is a theory without principles of its own. Essentially, the theory of natural selection is nothing more than the systematic deployment of information about organisms and their environment in order to evaluate, quantitatively if possible, otherwise at least comparatively, the probabilities that variant organic lineages will survive and reproduce. The considerations which determine these probabilities are drawn from other branches of biology and from the physical sciences of the environment. Now, there surely has been progress since Darwin's time in the theory of natural selection because of increased sophistication concerning strategies and statistics of biological survival. But I repeat, there was no refinement of the principle of natural selection, because there never was such a principle, either in Darwin's work or thereafter. And when one examines the propositions which have been set forth as proposed principles of natural selection, one always finds that they are either vacuous or derivative from other bodies of biological theory. Now, I stress the thesis of the non-existence of a principle of natural selection, not just because I claim some credit for articulating it, though that is a reason, but because it is indispensable to the advocates of cosmic evolution, of a cosmic evolutionary explanation of fundamental laws. One obviously would not achieve the program of law without law, which is Wheeler's term, if it depended upon a principle of natural selection which was not vacuous, which was itself a fundamental law. One would just have pushed back the sequence of laws one step. Indeed, I would say a little bit more. It seems to me, when I read the advocates of an evolutionary explanation of fundamental natural law, I find that they tacitly assume the non-existence of a principle of natural selection, even though they do not say so explicitly. Now, the pioneer of the evolutionary explanation I think you were reading first when I was thought when I when I was reading Leibniz. Now you will have first and I will read. The pioneer of the evolutionary explanation of fundamental laws was Charles Saunders Peirce. He was inspired by Darwin's theory of natural selection and by the kinetic theory of gases, and one of the earliest people to recognize an underlying similarity of the logic of those two theories, especially regarding the emergence of uniformities from the play of chance. In his speculations on cosmology, he proposed a vast extrapolation of this emergence of order out of chance. And here is the passage that you see in front of you. In the beginning, infinitely remote, there was a chaos of unpersonalized feeling, which, being without connection or regularity, would properly be without existence. This feeling, sporting here and there in pure arbitrariness, would have started the germ of a generalizing tendency. Its other sportings would be evanescent, but this one would have a growing tendency. Thus, the tendency to habit would be started. And from this, with the other principles of evolution, all the regularities of the universe would be evolved. Now, when I read this passage 50 years ago as an undergraduate, I found it inspiring. And I still find it inspiring, since I see how Peirce anticipated by nearly 100 years such ideas as order out of disorder and strange attractors. But as an undergraduate, I thought I understood the passage. Whereas now, I know that I did not understand it then and do not understand it now. But I think there's been some progress. I think I can identify what is baffling in Peirce's statement and what is unsatisfactory about it. As I pointed out earlier, the theory of evolution has three components: theory of variation, of selection, and of inheritance. Since Peirce gives only the broadest sketch of his idea of cosmic evolution, we cannot expect from him a detailed scenario of variation, selection, and inheritance. But with regard to variation, there is a profound conceptual difficulty. Think about games of chance, not just his conjecture about cosmic chance, but simple games of chance like dice. In all games of chance, the random processes occur in a theater with a fixed structure, like a dice board, governed by gravitation and by friction, with dice of a definite shape. So there is a background, and there is a fixed background to the play of chance. Furthermore, in the great games of chance envisaged by the theory of biological evolution and also by the theory of prebiotic evolution, there is a background. The theater of variation, according to neo-Darwinian biological evolutionary theory is provided by the biochemistry of nucleic acids. The exact nature of these molecules and of the chemical forces among them is physically fixed. Variation consists in novel combinations of the fixed building blocks. The theory of variation in prebiotic evolution is much larger than in biotic evolution. It's constituted by the prebiotic molecules available for combinations and associations. But what conceivably could be the theater for Persian cosmic variation? It is doubtful even that the range of possibilities within which sporting occurs is well defined unless there's a theater with some definite structure. Furthermore, he uses terms like evanescence and stability, but how can the various sportings be compared with respect to their evanescence and stability without some criterion of proximity? And a criterion of proximity depends upon a primitive topology of the theater. And topology is structure. Now, once even a small amount of structure is allowed, it's allowed that the theater of cosmic evolution is endowed with some kind of fixed structure, there is a retrenchment from Peirce's program of giving an evolutionary account of every general law. That's all I'm going to say about Peirce, because just such a retrenchment from Peirce's program is what you find in Alfred North Whitehead's Philosophy of Organism. Still an evolutionary theory with regard to fundamental natural laws, but there is a theater with some fixed properties. Now, I have very, very briefly, essentially, to say something about Whitehead's metaphysics, or his Philosophy of Organism. Like Leibniz's monadology, it supposes the ultimate actual entities of the world to be essentially mental, or since they're primitive ones, proto-mental. You could still talk about the physical characterization of actual entities, or at least of societies of them, and such physical characterizations will be roughly correct. But they're not the whole story. They are abstractions from the rich inner lives of the actual entities. So far, Whitehead is very much in agreement with Leibniz's monadology. He differs from Leibniz, however, in ascribing to his actual entities finite, indeed very brief, temporal duration. And he rejects entirely Leibniz's doctrine that the monads are windowless, for he postulates that each actual entity in the initial stage of its genesis recapitulates to some extent the feelings of earlier entities. He introduces a technical term, prehension, suggesting a relation more primitive than apprehension or comprehension, to characterize the recapitulation of an old actual entity by a new one. Furthermore, prehension is not deterministic. Exactly how a new actual entity combines the feelings which it inherits from previous entities is somewhat a matter of chance. So there can be innovations in the formation of a new entity. These innovations constitute the component of variation in a Whiteheadian theory of cosmic evolution. For the most part, innovations are infinitesimal, but they can have a grand cumulative effect. A kind of natural selection eventuates in the formation of societies of actual entities with robust characteristics, the society being self-perpetuating in virtue of the prehension of characteristics of its previous members. And now, what are some examples of such societies? An individual electron is a chain, a temporal chain of occasions. The personality of a human being is a temporal chain of occasions. The vastest species of society, here you see Whitehead offering the explanation of the cosmic evolution of basic laws. The vastest species of society is what he calls a cosmic epoch. And here's what he says. hard enough to understand Whitehead when you see, when you read him, and it's very hard to take him in by ear alone. Oh, here it is. Thus, a system of laws determining reproduction in some portion of the universe gradually rises into dominance. It has its stage of endurance and passes out of existence with the decay of the society from which it emanates. Maxwell's equations of the electromagnetic field hold sway by reason of the throngs of electrons in a proton. Also, each electron is a society of electronic occasions, and each proton is a society of protonic. These occasions are the reasons for the electromagnetic laws, but their capacity for reproduction, whereby each electron and each proton has a long life, and whereby new electrons and new protons come into being, is itself due to these same laws. But there is disorder in the sense that the laws are not perfectly obeyed. That's a consequence of the innovations involved in each new occasion. The laws are not perfectly obeyed, and the reproduction is mingled with instances of failure. There is, accordingly, a transition to new types of order. Now, from this passage, one sees that Whitehead regards the fundamental laws of physics as products of evolution. But it is an evolution that takes place in a theater of potentiality, a theater governed by general principles which are not products of evolution. They're general principles which are applicable without exception. For instance, the proto-mentality of all actual entities, their transience, their prehension of their predecessors, their innovation, their integration of ingredients from the past, their objective immortality as ingredients in the experience of later entities. All these are principles of a metaphysical sort that are general but are not the results of evolution. So far as I know, Whitehead does not attempt to provide sufficient reasons for these metaphysical principles. Like Peirce, Whitehead was an indeterminist, and ipso facto, as an indeterminist, he limits the domain of validity of the principle of sufficient reason. But unlike Peirce, he seems willing to permit not only individual contingencies to be violations of the principle of sufficient reason, to occur without a sufficient reason, but also to permit certain general propositions, such as the ones that I just read to you, to lie outside the domain of validity of the principle of sufficient reason. Now, let me cite one more rather cryptic statement of Whitehead. In his late book, Adventures of Ideas, he cites with approbation an idea that he learned from Plato's late dialogue, the Timaeus. Plato talks about the receptacle, which is a kind of theater of existence upon which the Platonic forms are impressed. Now, here's what Whitehead says about the receptacle. The receptacle is expressly stated by Plato to be a difficult notion, so that we may safely put aside easy explanations of it. Then Whitehead says, I explain it to myself as the conception of the essential unity of the universe, conceived as an actuality, yet in abstraction from the life and motion in which all actualities must partake. Well, that is a cryptic characterization. But what it does say is that there is a theater within which the variation of actual entities is staged, and that theater has certain irreducible general principles, some of which I've already read to you, like the proto-mentality of the occasions and their transience. Now, suppose one takes this seriously. Then you have to take seriously the mortality of basic physical laws. They're products of evolution, they decay. so there must be some sort of evidence of their mortality. And now, where would you look? Presumably, the best place for us to look now is in the most remote galaxies that our telescopes can see. But that's not what we find. The best evidence we have from the remote galaxies does not confirm Whitehead's idea of the decay and the fallibility of the fundamental laws. The absorption spectra from galaxies 15 to 20 billion light years away are the same as the absorption spectra obtained in terrestrial laboratories from light passing through vapors of known chemical elements, provided, of course, that correction is made for the large Hubble redshift due to the fact that the distant galaxies are receding from us. Now, the agreement in these observed spectra from the galaxies with terrestrial spectra would be an absolutely astonishing coincidence if terrestrial chemical elements were not present in the remote galaxies, and if the laws of atomic physics and electromagnetism on Earth were not valid even in the remote galaxies. Accordingly, if the evolutionary conjecture is to be confirmed, it must be necessary to look beyond the remote galaxies. Where? Before the Big Bang or after the Big Crunch, whatever these prepositions and substances may mean. And that is the proposal of Lee Smolin's very interesting unpublished book, The Life of the Cosmos, to which I turn now. Now, Smolin stresses that the standard model of elementary particles requires 19 fundamental dimensionless parameters, whose role is primarily to determine the relative masses of the various elementary particles and the characteristics of the four fundamental forces, gravitational, weak, electromagnetic, and strong. This proliferation of apparent arbitrariness at the fundamental level is generally regarded as a serious blemish in the standard model, and the removal of this blemish motivates novel elementary particle theories like string theory. What Smolin proposes, however, is to keep the standard model, but to supplement it with an evolutionary explanation of the values of the 19 parameters. He makes two cosmological postulates. I've read up to there. Here is the quotation where you have the indentation. The first postulate is that quantum effects prevent the formation of singularities at the moment of the Big Bang or at the time of the Big Crunch, singularities at which time starts or stops. So time does not end in the center of black holes, and it doesn't end at the moment of the vast cosmic explosion of the Big Bang, but it continues into some new region of space-time, connected to our universe only in its first moment. Going back towards the alleged first moment of our universe, we find that our Big Bang could be just the result of such a bounce in a black hole that formed in some other region of space and time. If we accept this, then we have not only the inevitable inaccessible regions, as cosmologists talk of, we have the possibility that these regions could be universes as large and as varied as the universe that we can see. Moreover, as our own visible universe contains an enormous number of black holes, there must be enormous numbers of these other universes. There are at least as many universes as there are black holes in our universe. But surely if we believe this, we must believe that there are many more than that. For why should not each of these universes also have stars that collapse the black holes and thus spawn new universes? So he has a cosmogony, a theory of the birth of universes, but it's cosmogony in the plural. It's birth not only of this universe, but of many, many of them. Now, the second postulate. The second postulate is that the forms, the basic forms of the laws. Remember, he's talking about the standard model of elementary particle theory. That the basic forms of the standard model don't change during the balance. So that the standard model of particle physics describes the world both before and after the balance. However, I will assume that the parameters of the standard model do change during the balance. This is his theory of variation, his theory of cosmic evolution. How do they change? Well, he doesn't say very much about mechanism of change. All he says is that in the absence of any definite information, I will postulate that these changes are small and random. These two postulates constitute the component of variation in Smolin's theory of cosmic evolution. He proposes a cosmogony in the plural. The variable entities are universes, and the theater in which the variation occurs is governed by the principles of quantum gravity, as yet not fully constructed, and also by the form of the standard model of elementary particle theory. It is the component of natural selection which I find most striking in Smolin's theory. Universes with different values of the 19 parameters differ greatly from each other in their propensity. I've given you the postulates. Now what I'm doing is summarizing rather briefly Smolin's argument on the basis of the postulates. He says that there are universes with different values of the 19 parameters. In fact, when new universes are spawned, there are small changes of the parameters, and so one has a multiplicity of universes with different values of these parameters. Now, he restricts attention to universes with sufficient matter that gravitation will slow down and eventually reverse the expansion of the universe, eventually leading to a collapse and a balance. Such a universe will produce at least one descendant by his idea that at the final crunch, the final collapse, there is continuity to a new universe. But unless the universe that has just deceased produces a star that is sufficiently massive to collapse into a black hole, it will have only one descendant. Now, if we borrow from population genetics the term fitness, which means roughly expected number of descendants, then the fitness of a universe is determined by its propensity for producing black holes. The center of Smolin's argument, which requires the deployment of much astrophysical information plus some extrapolation conjecture, is the sketch of a demonstration that the range of the 19 parameters which determine universes with high fitness, that is, with propensity to produce lots of massive stars which will collapse into black holes which will spawn new universes, that range of the parameters is very narrow. And just as a nice bonus, it is a range in which one has high probability of the formation of fairly heavy elements like calcium and iron, which are useful for life as we know it. Consequently, here is his conclusion. In the ensemble of all universes, the distribution of the values of the parameters of the standard model is highly peaked. Most universes have parameter values in the narrow range which generates many progeny. If one then assumes that our universe is typical, then an explanation is provided for the values of the parameters of the standard model found in this, our universe. Now, comment on Smolin. What he takes for granted is a background in which the general form of the laws of the standard model, the symmetries postulated by the standard model, are accepted. He gives no sufficient reason for those. What he has pretended to give is sufficient reason, by evolutionary means, of the 19 parameters, but no sufficient reason for the form of the standard model. So it is a very incomplete realization of the vision of law without law. And since that's so, I turn now to the program of John Archibald Wheeler, which in some ways antedated and inspired Smolin's program. It's not as detailed with regard to this to the selection that I just outlined, but it's more general in other ways. Now, you cannot expect from Wheeler a definitive answer to the question under questions under consideration. Partly because he's so inventive. He's inventive and exploratory, and he's self-critical. He's criticized some of his own earlier answers, such as reprocessing of the universe, which is an idea that Smolin picked up. But there's a certain architecture in his program of law without law, which I think is very interesting, and I don't think has been sufficiently pointed out. It's a three-tiered methodological structure. The highest tier consists of one or more suggestive but somewhat cryptic principles. Now, just you'll see by some quotations that they are indeed cryptic. Here's one. Ask if the universe is not best conceived as a self-excited circuit. Or here's another. Genesis takes place through observership. What does that mean? Well, it means that there is no existence without observation somehow precipitating the existence. So, and I'll give you a little bit more detail about these principles in the first tier, but I want to give you the structure of this program. Now, the second tier consists in unpacking the general principles in order to obtain a mathematical framework. The general principles tend to be formulated in ordinary prose. That's the second. And the mathematical framework, which he's most interested in getting, is the framework of quantum mechanics. But the framework thus obtained is less detailed than the standard fundamental theories of physics, and it leaves room for evolution. And that evolution is the third tier of his program. In this tier, he proposes that the free play of natural selection in the presence of innumerable contingencies of cosmic history generates both the forms and the parameters of the detailed laws of the detailed laws of physics. Now I want to say a little bit more about the first tier. During the past two decades, Wheeler's first tier has emphasized participation of the observer in constituting the world. In place of an infinite regressive explanation, he says there is no alternative but loop, and such a loop as the following. Physics gives rise to observation participancy. That is, it allows the evolution of life, including human life, including experimental physicists, who have apparatus which they observe. Observation participation gives rise to information, and information gives rise to physics. The loop is completed. And there is no existence. That is, there are no definite properties until observations are completed and registered. Now, Wheeler claims to be following Niels Bohr's admonition that these experimental conditions constitute an inherent element of the description of any phenomenon to which the term physical reality can be properly attached. That's a quotation from Bohr's answer to criticisms of Einstein. But there's a vast difference between Bohr's emphasis that there's no real description of a physical property without reference to an experimental arrangement. There's a vast difference between Bohr's principle and Wheeler's use of it. What Bohr does is to use his maxim to interpret the formalism of quantum mechanics. Wheeler has the ambition, remember this is law without law, he has the ambition of deriving the quantum principle from his aphorisms. The derivation that he hopes for constitutes the second tier of his program. He believes in fact that has partially been accomplished, at least to the point of proving that the probabilities for microphysical transitions must be calculated in the standard quantum mechanical way by taking absolute squares of complex amplitude. That's an important part of quantum mechanics. However, he considers the derivation of the totality of standard quantum mechanics, like the rules for describing the state of a composite system, or the quantum dynamics. He thinks those are not completed yet. But he hopes that they will be. And they will all be gotten by unpacking his idea of a participatory universe. Now, the third tier of his program, the evolutionary explanation of detailed physical laws, depends upon the completion of the second tier. It depends on the antecedent establishment of quantum mechanics. The reason is that quantum fluctuations provide the rich theater in which the natural selection for laws takes place. He envisages, for example, that he can give an explanation of the four-dimensionality of space and time. And he does so by a kind of natural selection in a superspace which is governed by quantum fluctuation. Now, those are the three tiers. Now, Wheeler's program is ambitious and visionary. There's probably no living theoretical physicist who surpasses Wheeler in the proposal of heuristically valuable ideas. I have some reservations about the only part of his program which I have any technical competence in, that is the second tier in which he claims to derive a substantial part of quantum mechanics from his general principle of a participatory universe. As to assessment of details of his vast work on space-time structure, I think that has to be left to an expert. But the most important philosophical question for our present topic is the status of the general principle of the first tier of his program. Suppose it's so. Suppose that the principle of a participatory universe is purged of all obscurity. We want to know, what is its logical status? Is this principle necessary? And if so, how? Now, he says the following, he hints in his belief that somehow the necessity of the basic law is logical necessity. And here's the way he puts it, that one can get so much from so little, he's reflecting upon the history of modern theoretical physics, that one can get so much from so little, almost everything from almost nothing, inspires hope that we will someday complete the mathematization of physics and derive everything from nothing, all law from no law. Now, I find that hope difficult to understand, for I see no logical inconsistency in the conception of a universe without awareness of itself. Furthermore, I am baffled by those who do find this conception to be that they will still accept vast stretches of cosmic history in which there's no awareness at all. There's only the physical reality, and then somehow awareness comes after many billions of years of evolution. So awareness is only latent, not actual, in most of the history of the universe. Well, if you can accept that, then I don't see why you can't accept the consistency of a universe without any awareness of itself whatever. What seems to me comprehensible is that as a matter of ultimate fact, not as a matter of logical necessity, the universe is so constituted as to ensure the emergence of awareness, but I see no sufficient reason for this ultimate fact, if one still is after a Leibnizian principle of sufficient reason, unless you have recourse to theology. And if so, then the existence of a designer who is capable of creating a universe thus characterized would itself become the puzzling matter of ultimate fact, needing a sufficient reason. Whatever choice is made, there seems to be a limit to the validity of the principle of sufficient reason. Well, in a way, I'm at an end. What conclusion should we draw from the foregoing rumination? I would say the best answer is uncertainty. But I suppose I shall not be allowed to get away with that answer, even though it's the best one. There will be voices demanding, how shall we be uncertain, O Master? So let me go against my grain and try to say something more. I'll make five last remarks. The first remark, the evolutionary explanation of the laws of nature is a reasonable proposal, which is undoubtedly true in many domains, surely in biology, and possibly even in particle and space-time physics. How far such explanations extend is a scientific question whose answer is inseparable from fundamental research in physics and cosmology, particularly research on the early universe. Second remark, however far the evolutionary explanation can be pressed, it will presuppose the theater within which natural selection takes place. And that theater has some irreducible, minimal fixed properties. The principles of Wheeler are only guesses at those fixed properties. They are not demonstrations of the necessity of them. Third remark. From a logical standpoint, these fixed properties of the theater of existence are contingencies. But clearly they are not ordinary contingencies. They're not ordinary contingencies like whether a radium atom decays this year or next. They are contingencies that constitute the framework within which the entire cosmic drama takes place. And in this sense, they are the necessities which constrain all subordinate bodies of natural law. Let me go back and use the language of Plato, which I think is suggestive, even though dark. They are not necessities in the sense of intrinsic relations among forms, as are the necessities of mathematics. They are necessities in the sense of being the uneliminable structural characteristics of the receptacle of existence. The receptacle of existence, and I think this is what basic physics shows, the receptacle of existence is not entirely passive to the imposition of form, but has its own graininess, which must be respected by the imposition of form. Now that remark is cryptic, but Plato was right. Receptacle is a difficult notion. Four, even if the most general principles have no sufficient reason, but simply are the basic facts about the universe, epistemologically, they may appear to us as something quite different from brute fact. Why should that be so? Well, a possible explanation is looking at our adaptation to the world around us, the accommodation of the human intellect to the world into which we are born. We are, after all, little gingerbread men in the great cosmic oven, and it would not be surprising that the basic properties of that oven have left their traces on our nature. Fifth remark, and this remark is very appropriate for the London School of Economics. The search for principles of great generality at the topmost level of the hierarchy of scientific laws is methodologically very valuable, regardless of the ontological status of these principles. There is historical evidence of the fruitfulness of search for great general principles. I refer to the principle of nearby action, the principle of special relativity, of Galilean relativity, various conservation the principle of equivalence, which underlies general relativity, the gauge principle, which is essential in modern particle theory. One virtue of the search for general principles is that we don't seem to be confronted with an infinity of alternative principles, at least not of actually proposed general principles, in the way that we are of alternative inductive generalizations or alternative law-like statements. Such principles are all the more valuable if they allow or at least guide the derivation of a rich mathematical theory. And at this point I would say we should be very tolerant of guidance, even when deduction, as Wheeler hoped, is not possible. In other words, I think that Wheeler has made a real contribution to methodology with his articulation of the first two tiers of his program, general principles, then somehow guiding, but maybe a guided deduction, a heuristic deduction from those general principles of a rich mathematical structure like quantum mechanics. Then possibly the third tier can also be completed if it is the case that we have cosmological evidence that in a world governed by quantum fluctuations, there is further evolution, further natural selection of detailed physical laws. So I think that Wheeler's three tiers are very suggestive, even though I'm, as you can see, quite skeptical of the details. Those are my five remarks. Thank you.
Professor Shimoni has agreed kindly to answer some questions. I think perhaps we should have a couple of minutes break in case there are people to allow people who don't want to stay for the question period to leave. The few people who are upstairs, if they feel pregnant with a question, then the delivery room's downstairs because that's where the microphones are. And so if they'd like to come down, then they should do that in the time that other people are leaving. But we'll have a couple of minutes break now, and then there'll be questions. Okay, well, we have two roving microphones. I'd ask you to, if you do want to ask a question, if you could indicate that to me. I'll try and sit somewhere where I'm not blocked by the flowers. You'll get the microphone so that, and if you can speak nice and loud. And so Jeremy, please, Max, Jeremy Butterfield.
First, I'd like to say that as a member of the Abner Shimoni fan club, some of us here are saying that this was quintessential Abner, magisterial, playful, adventurous, and to a boring person like me, perhaps hard to believe. But I would like to ask you, Abner, whether you, in that survey of proposals for having a sort of theatre or receptacle, and then in addition to that natural selection story about selection of laws, whether you firmly favour that selection coming from, as in Smolin, Peirce, Whitehead, coming from natural selection, as in variation, selection, inheritance. It seems to me that in the Wheeler you don't really have those three components of natural selection as ordinarily conceived. You have rather a theatre, a receptacle, and then you have some kinds of further constraint or selection, but it's not of the form large population of variations, only some of which survive or do a job well or get transmitted. So I want to know in your heart how much you favour, within the constraints of the theatre, the selection being done by large populations and the death of most.
Jeremy, I didn't get the last question that you asked. I understood the preliminary much more.
Well, the question is, as I understand these matters, some proposals say, once we have the theatre or the receptacle fixed and admittedly contingent, but doesn't look like brute fact to us. Some proposals say there is then evolution. Other proposals say there is then some kind of further, let's not call it selection, but contingency about how things are, which doesn't have to be the result of a process of evolution. For example, I don't think, from my position of ignorance, that Wheeler is proposing particularly natural selection. Of course, Smolin certainly is. It's got variation, selection, inheritance. And I want to know why, in your heart, you're particularly attracted to natural selection as the way of making this further choice of contingencies, individualities, once the theatre is set up.
Well, part is logical economy. That is, as you see, I have expressed a skepticism about the more radical aspects of the program. I don't believe in law without any law whatsoever. I believe that there are some general laws, and that is the way the world is. By the way, I'm very open to what that character would be. I didn't mention, because of limitations of time, various versions of the anthropic principle. They're very interesting. The strong anthropic principle, the most interesting of them, is that the world must be such as to allow the evolution of life as we know it, with observation as we know it. And partly I didn't mention it because Wheeler's participatory universe is not very different from strong anthropic principle. I'm hospitable to a number of conjectures. Let's see what we can make of them. Conjectures themselves, of course, have to be assessed as any high-level scientific generalization must be assessed on the basis of evidence. What I was saying is that whatever the character of this high-level generalization may be, it's going to be a kind of brute fact. This is the way the world is. If it's a teleological brute fact, if it's a materialistic brute fact, or if it's the kind of proto-mentalistic brute fact of Whitehead, it's still brute fact. Now, one might say, well, why not, once you admit it, one brute fact, why not allow all of them, all enough basic laws of physics to have your whole space-time physics, your whole elementary particle theory, from which presumably atomic physics is, and nuclear and atomic molar physics and all emerge. Well, it's a common. It's certainly a minimum is, if one can reduce all the principles to a small number, that is a kind of understanding. That is, in fact, the answer Coates gives in his preface to the English edition of Principia. He says some of the Aristotelians have accused Newton of reintroducing essences without using the name. It is of the essence of matter that one piece of it attracts another piece according to the gravitational law. And why is this in principle different from Aristotle's program of essences of various species? And then he coached by Newton, says, yes, but there's a difference between having as many different essences as there are different animals and plants and minerals, and having a very small number of principles from which you derive the laws of falling body on Earth, and the mechanics of the solar system, and the tides, and the behavior of the moon, and so on. And of course, there is a difference. So, yes, that would be one.
Well, could I say, I don't know how much I also enjoyed your lecture, fascinating range. I very much enjoyed your lecture and the great range of topics that you've introduced, and I think it's an absolutely splendid occasion. But the specific question I wanted to ask you, so far we've talked about evolution as bringing us to our present state of affairs, the present laws we have and how selection may have produced our present laws of physics. But I wanted to ask your opinion about two historical episodes which look at continuing change in the laws of physics. The first example is Boltzmann, who thought that maybe with some giant fluctuation entropy would suddenly start to decrease instead of increase, and perhaps in other parts of the universe that's already happening. And of course Dirac, who thought that maybe the fundamental constants themselves functions of time. Now there may be good sort of empirical evidence against them, but two episodes in the history of physics fit into your general evolutionary program?
Yeah. Well, things have changed since Boltzmann. That is, Boltzmann had no reason to think of a space-time structure other than an open universe. It's an infinite Euclidean space and an endless time. There was no reason whatever. That was the framework in which all the physics he knew fitted perfectly well. Who could have anticipated the two geniuses like Riemann and Clifford and Clifford thought that even topology of the universe different than the one that is classically seen. But with very, very few exceptions, he accepted a four-dimensional space-time which had three dimensions of space, one of time, all extending infinitely. Now, given that, there's a lot of room for free play of combination. With infinitely much time, many, many different combinations of the indestructible atoms. So many, many different combinations could occur, and practically none of them are combinations in which life would occur. But infinitely much time, even if it has infinitesimal probability, finite but very small probability, then with virtual certainty, in the infinite play of chance over infinite time, there will be realized a universe in which life will evolve. That was Boltzmann's conjecture in one of his popular lectures. Now, things are changed once one has the idea of a finite universe. That is, if the finite universe, if from Big Bang to Big Crunch, is all there is, then you certainly can't use a modification of Boltzmann, right? Try it many, many times. Let's look at the statistics of these worlds. What Smolin did was, in a way, to recover Boltzmann's Spielraum, but he did so by saying that, well, for quantum considerations, the Big Bang really is singularity. Continue to the Big Bang, you do have infinitely many universes after all. And then we can talk about statistics. Of course, yes, also, things are different now from 120 years or so ago. He has some physical information about cosmic density. And so he can talk about conditions for giving rise to something that looks like a new universe. Then comes his one guess. His one guess is that each time such a new cosmos is formed, it could have different parameters. So it's a clever thing. I found his book, which will be out year or two, exhilarating reading. I didn't believe it. When I read it, I felt like the Duke of Wellington's remark to the man who said, Mr. Smith, I believe, and he said, if you could believe that, you could believe anything. but it was very stimulating. I really don't like science fiction, but I like science that has a little bit of the wildness imagination of the best science fiction. Well, Smollett has.
I think actually Abner's just remarked, Abner here, sorry, it's just remarked on what I wanted to ask about. I had wanted to take the opportunity to ask a meta question and get Abner to talk a little bit about philosophy in general, since your very last remark in your 5 points about the methodological virtues of grand theorizing, you mentioned this being at home in LSE, and probably a way to point to the question I want to ask, which is a simple question about metaphysics, is that more at home in LSE is although there's a little infighting between Popper and the positivists, more at home at LSE is a kind of nitty-gritty, see to it that your scientific conjectures are very responsive to the immediate empirical environment, that kind of point of view about how very wedded to empirical the immediate empirical world the science should be, and you have really quite a speculative view about science, and so I had wanted to get you to say more, as you've just begun to do, about your view about the relationship between metaphysics and science, and what constraints you're happy with to put on this adventuresome science of the kind that you like.
Observation. Now, I'm an empiricist, but of course came the inevitable thought. what I think is crucial in good epistemology, in good methodology, is how to get the right meshing of an empiricistic element and a rationalistic element in our thinking. And I think that problem isn't completely solved. I think there have been many contributions to it. And I am suggesting that Wheeler is one of a number of people who have made contributions to this combination.
I was interested, if you could say just a little more about the general way in which that could go. Maybe there aren't any general remarks to make. You just do it on a case-by-case basis. But I think that you do have rather worked-out views, and hoped you'd share them with us.
I think even though we are certainly not on the same side on many methodological questions, we certainly don't believe that fitting curves to a finite amount of data is the way to go. Fitting curves has its utility. It's a way of summarizing data. But we also know that there are infinitely many curves that will go through any finite set of points. But we also know that's being too constrained and too inhibited about the data. One has to be freer. Well, Popper correctly said that there's a role for conjecture. What I'm suggesting is a kind of exegesis of that. What kind of conjectures are likely to be fruitful? Well, I have no prescription, but I can certainly point out to you some examples which have been fruitful. They are conjectures which have a kind of, they appeal to our rationality, even though they cannot possibly be logically necessary. That's one peculiarity. The principle of equivalence that the behavior of bodies in a gravitational field is the ratio of the gravitational mass to the inertial mass is independent of the material. Often appealing. Very beautiful though. Certainly not logically necessary. And it certainly was a guiding principle in Einstein's search for a relativistic version of gravitation. So I think principles that, without asking too much, why does it seem reasonable to me? Why does this have rational? Why is it rational? I don't really know why. But symmetry principles of various sorts do seem rational to me, and I know historically that they've been extraordinarily fruitful. And if one can use these to start filling out the mathematical framework, instead of trying to get the mathematical framework in the way we're quite sure won't work by something analogous to curve fitting. We know it won't work because there are infinitely many ways to do it. Whereas the work in the opposite direction, from such a guiding principle to a mathematical framework, may be less arbitrary. Maybe it may not be unique, but it's full of suggestions, and it's freer from arbitrariness than going in the other direction. So I can't give you a prescription. I can only pick out a number of such principles that have worked very well. I don't even believe the principle nearby action is universally true. Much of my professional work has been on giving arguments for the existence of non-locality when one deals with entangled, separated physical senses. But you haven't even then completely scrapped the principle of nearby action. There's something subtle going on. There's a successor to the principle of nearby action, which the principle of nearby action is the correspondence limit. So, these principles are not for sure, they're not permanent, but they're extraordinarily rich. And we should look at them for hints on how to combine a rationalistic with an empiristic element in our methodology. That's the best answer I can give you.
Have you any comments on the physicist? Have you any comments? You know, the physicists now are talking about the known physics. Immediately after the Big Bang.
Wait, I'm not here.
Shall I start again? The physicists now, they are saying about the so-called unknown physics. In the very first thousands of a picosecond, 10 to the minus 15th. Unknown physics. Now, what do they mean by that? Do they mean that the laws of physics which they apply after the first picosecond or after the first thousandth of a picosecond, and they can develop their theories, and during this first dark period, there may be some different type of laws, or perhaps something happened during this first thousandth of a picosecond which created these physical laws which we are actually using today? It's like almost like a type of electrical motor where you turn it left or right, it becomes a left-hand side or right-hand side at the very first moment of creation. And my basic question to you is that, do you actually accept the theory of the Big Bang? Because you made some comment earlier, sort of as if you had dismissed it as some sort of a fairy tale.
If you want to find a plea in what I said, it certainly is a plea for imagination. And the unknown physics is what you have to do is understand the physics we have now, and where there are troublesome areas, things that we don't fully understand, things that don't fit together, and one should take these trouble spots very seriously. And pay attention, use those to stimulate the imagination, and be open-minded about alternative proposals. Fine. But you have to know the difference between a conjecture and a fairly well-established scientific principle. I think that if anybody does research, has to have a little bit of a mad scientist and a little bit of a scientist. They have to be kept in the right balance, the right tension. I really don't like science fiction, and the reason I don't like it is partly because it is oblivious to the really inspiring the inspiration of non-fictional science, the real thing. And another reason I don't like it is it lacks imagination. Whereas the real thing is full of it. But being aware of what we don't know and spending a good part of one's time thinking about it, thinking about great areas of interest, not just, we all work on small areas that we can hope for a result. I'm talking about the great areas, very stimulating. Spend some of one's time. I have found that thinking about the reduction of the wave packet I suspect I will not find the answer in my lifetime, and I suspect nobody will find the answer in my lifetime. I hope somebody can. It's been wonderful. It's really been very good for suggesting smaller problems, some of which were solvable. Now, I don't know if I'm giving you a credo, which is not quite the same as an answer.
But your answer, point blank, do you accept the Big Bang Theory or are you skeptical about it?
I didn't.
Do you accept the Big Bang Theory or are you skeptical about it?
I depend on authority. No. What happened? No, I'm not a cosmologist. I love to read about it. I hope that in the time remaining to me I will learn some cosmology. I'm retired, and that means I could be a student again, which is what I really want to be. One of the things I want to learn is quite more. So 20 years from now, maybe I can answer your question with some authority, but not now. We know there's a lot of that. Cosmic background from radiation is remarkable. It's very hard to explain unless you believe that something happened, cataclysmic. And the fact that the farther out you go, the faster the galaxies are going. Why should that be? It didn't all start at the same time. And the faster ones are the ones that got the furthest, and they're relatively little. Deceleration from gravitation or friction of any sort, they still have greater velocities than the ones that didn't get that far. Well, all that fits into a Big Bang theory, but that is certainly not an expert answer.
Okay, well, thanks very much. I think we've perhaps better call it a day there. Anyone who's got any more questions can raise them with Abner at the reception, which is about to start in the Cinecom room. As Abner remarked, the work by Wheeler that he was talking about connects with, involves strong anthropic principle, SAP, participatory principle, PAP, and something you can call the final anthropic principle, FAP. Now, in a famous review of this material in Scientific American by Martin Gardner, he expressed the view that any of these principles could just as well be called the completely ridiculous anthropic principle. Crap. Now, I had always thought that I would go to my grave believing that Martin Gardner was right, but I'd, as usual, not bargained for Abner Shimoni, who's made me think again. So I think we should thank him very much for what was a very rich and stimulating talk, and for the wonderful way that he answered questions.